Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Right. Hello. Hello, Jeff. You didn't dress up for the podcast?
I wanted to say hi, Ileana, but I feel like I should say hi, Audrey, instead.
Oh, you're actually well, this is my shout-out to the online PCM Film Festival. Tonight would have been the opening night of the festival. And so I wanted to show this. This is like a big deal for me.
Perfect.
And so this is what I would have been wearing on the
Well, you look amazing, and I'm going to let our lovely producer, Ryan, know that music's coming in a little hot, if we could just slowly fade that out. But
obviously, no technical difficulties at all.
This is a global pandemic, people. Give us a break.
Oh, and this is a dress. There's no reporters to ask me, but it's Tahari.
I love it.
Homekeeping score. And then now, I'm going to multitask. So we've seen the dress. I went aqua, by the way. What do you think? I was kind of really going for a retro 1959, 1969 vibe.
I think it's great. This is another reason our podcast listeners have to check out the YouTube, because every week, Ileana comes in with the glamour.
I'm trying. Okay, now I'm going to multitask. This is going to be fun. This is for charity, but it's also super fun. I'm not going to get this, the name of the sweatshirt. This is a sweatshirt I was given. And I don't have my phone in front of me, and I don't want to say the name wrong, but if you go to my Instagram, we'll get, you know, we'll tag it and do all of that kind of stuff. I'm winging the show sort of completely today, just because I think it's fun to be kind of on the edge. But anyway, this is this amazing sweatshirt, and the proceeds of it are going to go to charity, but I'm going to wear it for the rest of the show. And I think I've done everything. So hello to the TCM Film Festival fans. I really miss not having our opening night. It's such a fun sort of a hang with our movie people, you know.
There are people. Well, hopefully they're listening at least online to our TCM fans. We love you. We see you. At least you can watch movies right now.
And we can get some questions from them. And then the other funny, well, there's quite a number of funny things, But anyway, tell me about our guest today, because, you know, normally I like to prepare, but today I'm winging it. So
Paul Fishbein is I would say he is sort of works on the fringes of mainstream filmmaking, but he's a filmmaker and very immersed in the world of filmmaking. So, Ileana, catch me up. Did he connect with you?
Yes. Well, we did. We met because... Now I'm trying to think. He's got this documentary out, which we're going to talk about. This cult movies. Mm-hmm. I have not seen it, and I did the interview like 2.5 years ago. I believe it was my pal Joe Dante got me involved, and Joe said it's going to be you and me and John Waters and Kevin Pollak, all people I've worked with. So we hung out all day and we talked about movies. I have not seen the results of it because it was, you know, I participate in a lot of movie interviews. So I'm really looking forward to it. And hopefully Paul will tell us all about it. But then you told me something right before the top of the show.
So in the same way that cult filmmaking sort of hangs on the satellite fringes of traditional filmmaking, Paul also has a history in adult films. So he's the creator of the AVN Awards show, which is the Oscars of adult filmmaking.
Okay, so we're going to ask about this, right?
Oh, I would love to. He co-created a scripted show for Showtime that is called Submission. That's like BDSM themed. Ileana's laughing on air, just so you
guys. I literally just did a spit take.
That's a spit take.
That was a classic. And that was actually a really, just for comedy folks out there, that was a really good spit take.
I love it. So, you know what? One thing I love about this show is we bring on all kinds of filmmakers. We've had the Christmas Critic on here. We cover everything. So if we've covered Christmas movies in depth, we've covered horror movies in depth. We're going to talk a little bit about nudity in film.
Well, now, I don't know if you know this about me, but I have never seen an adult movie. It's funny that when did they start calling them adult movies? They were, when I was a kid, they were called pornos and they played at the drive-in.
Yeah, there's still, I still get porn. I wanted to make sure, because I think maybe there's a bit of a stigma around the idea of porn, but at the same time, I mean, like the 70s were sort of like the heyday of like, kind of like classy adult films and porn.
Well, it just, I mean, a lot of nudity started coming into movies. Yeah.
So you've never seen Deep Throat?
No, God, no. No, I've actually never seen a pornographic movie. I remember when I lived in New York City in the 80s, I think it was Channel 35, used to actually show live pornography on television. And if you would be changing the channel, you'd suddenly go, like, you've got to get something. But no, it's not for me in any way, shape, or form. I don't understand it. I'm from Connecticut. I don't. Yes, I'm judging. Yes. So
that's fair. Well, it'll be interesting to have Paul on because he's obviously a brilliant guy. He's a documentarian. So
yeah,
I think we should ask him some of these questions. Like, how do you, like, where do you find the artfulness in adult filmmaking? Because I'd love to hear his perspective.
Yes. And also, post COVID, is anybody going to want to do a love scene again?
That's true. You
know? I mean, you're going to want to make sure. I mean, it's like we're going way down the line, but I was talking to a director friend of mine and I said, you know, who's going to want to go back to work and do a kind of a love scene? It's like, I feel like the face, and I keep saying this, the face of entertainment is really going to change. I don't know what it's going to be, but.
I just want to see the final scene of Casablanca with face masks on, or From Here to Eternity with the two of them on the beach making out with masks on.
Well, the other night there was a movie with, you know, a robbery movie. I think it was called Odds Against Tomorrow with Robert Ryan and Harry Belafonte. And of all the things in the universe, the movies from the 50s, they rob a bank and they're wearing surgical masks. So it looked like, I said, oh my God, it's COVID.
It's the corona.
The corona. You know, corona is a city, I think, on Long Island.
It's a tough time to be called Corona. There is a electronics store in Wisconsin, I believe it is, called COVID. Tough time to be called COVID, if that's the name.
I know, that's, yeah. I think we've mentioned this before. I have a friend named Jeffrey Epstein.
Ouch.
And he's an executive, you know, at a company too. So not a good time for that name. Now, before we get Paul on, do we have any questions, or did I mess that up? I sort of tweeted we were going to be doing something, but questions. I've moved to a new location in my house, unlike the people online. You know, it looks like you're in Maria Menounos's bedroom. What's happening there?
I know, I joked the other day when I was on air, this is my bedroom. I'm just
that's what it looks like.
I'm at Maria's place. You've been there before. Right near their studio, they have a little office, and some of the Maria Shrine is here as well. So for the podcast listeners, our wonderful CEO is featured on the wall behind me. But yeah, it's nice. We're social distancing. Don't worry. I show up. I Lysol the key that I used to get in and go straight to the office and work here. But it's been good.
Yes. What was I going to say? I was going to ask you something.
Questions, which if you want, I do have one.
Sure, let's do a question. Why not?
All
the time in the world.
They're wondering and hoping about Trailblazing Women. I don't know if you know anything about that series or if anything would be happening, but if it was happening, who's a woman that we haven't covered that you'd want to?
Oh my God, it's such a bland answer. There's so many. For me, I'm just going to say it. It's Barbara. Let's get Barbara. Yeah, Barbara Streisand, in terms of the trailblazer, you know, just her, first of all, her movie career and then her directing career, all sorts of philanthropy. And so when we were doing the show, which I loved it too, it was a great collaboration that I had with Turner Classic Movies. I of course would love to start it again. We had so many different areas that we wanted to cover, you know, independent filmmakers, stunt women. We wanted to do stunt women. So there's all sorts of areas in the motion picture business that we wanted to do. But I would definitely say, my God, can you imagine interviewing Barbara Streisand? I once met her, and that was really exciting. But I would love to interview Barbara Streisand. Sally Field, would love to interview Sally Field. Just because.
Have you met Sally Field?
Cool. I've met her over the years.
I feel like the two of you kind of have the same flavor.
Maybe. Maybe it's my hair.
Maybe it's the hair.
60s hair today.
The wit. Did you guys ever show up at the same auditions or anything?
Me and Sally Field, no. But I once, I'll tell you the craziest audition I ever had. Many, many years ago, there was a movie called Casper. They did a movie of Casper the Friendly Ghost. And it just was like, sometimes I don't know why, like a movie will sort of gain heat and everybody in the world's auditioning for it. And I remember sitting in line, and I saw Sissy Spacek. I saw Faye Dunaway, you know, I saw every, you know, young actor in Hollywood auditioning for Casper the Friendly Ghost. I forgot who actually got it. We'd have to look that up. But sometimes you see people, you know, kind of out and about, and you never know whether you want to mention it or not, you know.
Totally. I'm trying to see if we have any other questions. I should have probably prepped a couple of these before we went live.
No worries. The other thing I was just going to say, just my own personal thing, you know, I know everybody's been sharing highlights of the TCM Film Festival. I remember, God, just seeing him in person, seeing Jean-Paul Belmondo was like out of the box. That was really fun. I remember, and then later I interviewed her on the cruise, Leslie Caron. But Leslie Caron was being honored. She was on the red carpet, and I was with Allison Anders. And I, you know, I went up to her and I said, you know, I was all dressed up. I was on the red carpet, for God's sakes. I said, you know, Miss Caron, may I take your picture? And she kind of looked me up and down. She goes, I suppose so. Everybody else is.
I love it.
I was like, am I being snubbed by Leslie Caron? So that was cool. Meeting Barry Chase, who is a dancer, and she was in Cape Fear. And I ended up playing the same part in Cape Fear that she played. So meeting her. Of course, interviewing Jerry Lewis. And then finally for me, I think one night there was a night, they had a nitrate, was like one of these late night nitrate prints of Theodora Goes Wild. And I think that was at the Egyptian. And we all watched it. And that was, what an incredible, that was an incredible experience. But you know, the audience hangs, and just the, every year I would do my same joke, which was, and I can't do it. Oh, I should have said it at the top of the show. I would, my first joke of a movie I would intro is I'd say, welcome to the 17th annual TCM Film Festival, or as we like to call it, Coachella for shut-ins. Oh my God, I got one laugh.
It's very apt. It's a very apt observation. You know, before we move on to the guests, I do have one quick question. I saw that you tweeted about SNL, which I also got to catch this weekend.
Oh my God.
I want to talk about it with you.
I was really emotional. It just was a, you know, I guess just as a constant, and seeing, I keep talking about the same thing. There's a sense of intimacy of people trying new things, and the vulnerability of it, I find to be very touching. And even if it's not as successful, to me it doesn't really matter. There's just, you know, something about, you know, knowing that the family is holding the camera, and it brings us all back to kind of childhood, and just you're winging it, and there, people don't have as many inhibitions, I think. They're just trying things.
It's very human. It's like very disarming and vulnerable, and it's SNL is such an institution that there is a sense of peace given to you when you're like, the show must go on. Even if it's not the most polished episode, having it there does kind of instill a sense of like normalcy.
Well, I always remember the most that, you know, probably for me, the most famous thing in my lifetime was when Lorne Michaels, you know, post 9/11, and he said, are we, you know, that line where he said, are we, to, I think it was to Giuliani before he went cuckoo bird, you know, are we allowed to be funny? And I just thought that was just, again, touching. That's what comedy is. Comedy is, it's comedy and tragedy at the same, you know, at the same time. And I thought it was very moving. I mean, I was crying. It was just a relief to see, to, you know, we're all in this together, that kind of a spirit. And I told you, I'm addicted to watching the different talk shows. And seeing that some people are really good at it, and, you know, and funny, and some people are not as, they're a little bit too programmed, you know.
It's really interesting when you pull back all the gaffing lights and the sets, and you can really kind of see who really has that kind of X factor that makes you a star. I mean, with SNL, it was so interesting to see these comic performers. I'm not going to use any names, but I felt like some flew more than others, and it just shows you. You know, the sketch I loved, actually, that I'm going to recommend to our audience was a newer cast member named Egon Wodum, who, beautiful black young actress,
yes,
did the makeup tutorial where she's drawing over her face.
I thought it was brilliant. That is an example. Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. And for me, it helps, you know, sort of rethink someone. I also thought Aidy Bryant, you know, I worked with on Shrill, so, but I was always a fan of hers before working with her, but I thought hers was hysterical. But yes, the makeup tutorial I thought was hysterical with the big eyebrows.
She played it so straight. And then you can just do a little bit of, almost like throwback, almost like old school, you know?
Yes, it is. I said that 3 weeks ago when we were doing this, like the 1950s.
Yeah.
Ernie Kovacs. So people are just trying new things. This is a new medium. And we're trying to figure out, you know, what works and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, what works the most is honesty, is just humor that comes out of the, you know, out of the situation. And again, seeing people's houses, the inside of people's houses, and, you know, they get very cute. They start getting like show and tell where they're showing little things. There was a great thing on Jimmy Fallon with Gwen Stefani cutting Blake Shelton's hair. And she like completely shaved the side of his head off. And she was doing a really good job. And then all of a sudden I was like, okay, I think he just shaved off the side of his head.
Oh, what a time. What a time to be alive.
When the camera turns off, you know. So just all these things. Like, that would have never happened. You know, Blake Shelton would have not gone on Tonight Show and said, Gwen's going to now, you know, cut my hair.
Exactly. It's what a time to be alive.
Yes. Anyway. All righty.
Well, let's get Paul on the line. Move on. Ryan, if we're ready, we can go ahead and bring Paul on the line. We gave some of his credentials. Definitely a filmmaker who works on the fringes of what's considered mainstream, but incredibly important work and interesting work that we're excited to dive into. Paul Fishbein, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Paul. Okay, remind us, we were talking at the top of the show, how did I get involved through this? I said Joe Dante, I think, called me,
what happened was we had shot most of this documentary, which was really turning into a documentary series, and we had contacted Joe about hosting, but we thought it would be fun to sort of have a hosting panel. So we picked a bunch of names of people who we thought were kind of in the business, but there were film buffs that we knew had all the film knowledge and that would enjoy it. And amongst the names was your name and Kevin Pollak and John Waters. And we asked Joe, who do you approve of? And he approved of a bunch of people. And you said yes right away. And it was one of the easiest hirings we did.
Wasn't that fun? I was so excited to see John Waters' wardrobe
Yeah.
Right. He had that, like, I think I, you know, I'm such a nerd. I secretly took photographs of all of his jackets.
Well, I remember what you said when you walked in. I introduced myself and you said, "This is so much fun. I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this just to talk about movies." And you were like very excited. So
I was. I mean, yeah. And with that group, my God.
Yeah.
John Waters is a cult. He's a walking cult movie, you know.
Yeah. John actually didn't want to be interviewed in another movie about Pink Flamingos. He didn't want to just do another Pink Flamingos interview. But hosting, he was happy to do because he could talk about everybody else's films as well.
Yes. And so tell everybody and me the name of it and where we can see it so we can get that out of the way. And when's it coming out and all of that?
Okay. So it's Time Warp, the greatest cult films of all time. It's a three-part documentary series. Part one, Midnight Madness, is coming out on April 21st. And that studies sort of the birth of the Midnight movie and repertory cinemas. And, you know, we have Big Lebowski and Rocky Horror Picture Show. This is Spinal Tap, Pink Flamingos, Harold and Maude, Freaks, Reefer Madness, Eraserhead. And we have great interviews with Jeff Bridges and John Turturro and Jeff Goldblum and, you know, everybody from Spinal Tap, Michael McKean and Rob Reiner. Part two comes out a month later, and that's on cult horror and sci-fi. And then a month after that, it's the cult comedies and the campy movies. And the truth of the matter is each of these three documentaries can be viewed independently. They stand alone. They're all about, each one is its own project. So if you watch the comedy one first and you watch the Midnight Madness second, it doesn't matter. And it comes out on the 21st on iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, anywhere where you rent or buy movies digitally.
Oh, neat. So I'll probably watch it on Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon Prime, you know, it's
yeah. And do you have to rent each one separately?
Yeah, but they're inexpensive. But then at the end, in 3 months, it'll all be available as a package if you want to own all three. So, great.
And will I get residuals? No, I'm kidding. So tell me some of the highlights of people's recollections. Like, let's start with Jeff Goldblum. Goldblum, of course.
Well, Jeff Goldblum. Well, the funny thing about Jeff Goldblum was he was probably my favorite person that we interviewed. Jeff Goldblum's interview started while he was in the makeup chair. He started doing his interview with the director. They were talking. They walked onto set having a conversation about cult movies. He just sat down. We started shooting. And he never stopped talking for 2 hours.
Yeah.
The funny thing about Jeff Goldblum is he demanded that he have his own hairdresser and that we would pay for his haircut. And so the hairdresser, we agreed to pay for the haircut. He was doing it for free. He was coming to the studio. And then, you know, I got the call that the haircut was going to be $1,500. And I almost fell over. I said, "Who has a $1,500 haircut?" And he comes into the studio and he had the haircut, but the guy came with him and he was trimming him and everything. And then we went through this unbelievable 2-hour interview. We got so much material. You could just do an entire movie of Jeff Goldblum talking. At the end of the entire thing, he gets up from the chair and he says to everybody, I hope you guys got what you were looking for. And then he looks at me and he says, "At least my hair looked good." And it's like, yeah, Jeff. But he was great. He was great. He was probably my favorite. And he talked about, I mean, we had him for Buckaroo Banzai, which is in part two. But he talked about Harold and Maude. He talked about many, many movies. So he's in it a lot.
Yeah, he's a movie buff.
Yeah.
I did a film. I may have said this in the television show, but there were many movies I've been in that are cult movies. And one of them is a movie I did with Jeff called Pittsburgh, which is very much, it's in the, you know, sort of Christopher Guest mockumentary type.
Yeah, movie. That was good. Good little independent film.
Like, yeah. But again, sort of under the radar, didn't get a wide release. What did Jeff Bridges say about Big Lebowski? That, I mean, again, becoming one of the biggest cult movies of all time.
Jeff loves The Big Lebowski. When we called his office, you talk about the biggest, maybe the biggest star that we got was the easiest person to get. His assistant said to Christine, our supervising producer, "Oh, Jeff loves The Big Lebowski." And we had an answer, yes, in 5 minutes. "Will you come to Santa Barbara and interview him?" "Yes." And it was great. And he was talk about a big Oscar winning star who is such a nice person, so low key, so self-deprecating, so friendly, so generous. I mean, you never know when you meet these people, but he was amazing. And he just told great story. I don't want to give them away, but there's a lot of Jeff. Well, I mean, I don't want to give away the highlights, but he talked about bringing his family to set one day and tells an outrageous story. Yeah, there's a great outrageous story about that.
And again, Jeff Bridges has also been in some really interesting offbeat cult movies, aside from, you know, he's had such a long, long career. Did he talk about his father at all, Lloyd Bridges?
No, just in passing, you know, talking about being in an acting family. But no, he talked mostly about Lebowski and the Coen brothers. And he's a photographer. And so whenever he shoots a movie, he takes his own photos during the entire production. And at the end of the production, he makes these beautiful books for all the cast members and crew. So he came in with his Big Lebowski book with these unbelievable behind the scenes pictures of people that didn't even know they were being photographed. And he just, you know, he brought that to show us. I mean, it's just the kind of guy he is. Yeah.
Beautiful. Now, what is the origin of the Midnight movie?
Well, the origin of the Midnight movie, New York City, the Elgin Theater, a man named Ben Barinholtz, who unfortunately passed away as we were finishing production. We did get to interview him, and he is in this movie. And he was sort of instrumental in really creating the Midnight movie. Man, El Topo is pretty much known as the first Midnight movie, but the one that really, before Rocky Horror, the one that really sort of put Midnight movies on the map other than Rocky Horror was Eraserhead. And Ben Barinholtz really worked closely with David Lynch to get Eraserhead onto screens, specifically the Elgin Theater in New York, and sort of kept trying. You know, the first time they showed the movie, you know, like 8 people showed up, and then 15 people showed up, and it was the slowest word of mouth ever. But eventually, Eraserhead became a phenomenon in that midnight showing in New York City, and then moved out to other theaters. And of course, Rocky Horror sort of became the quintessential midnight movie. And again, prior to home video, prior to DVDs or VHS, cable TV, if you wanted to see a movie, you had to see it in the theater. And if it failed the first time, you had to wait for it to come back. And sometimes they never came back.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly when I was growing up. And I remember Rocky Horror, you know, it spread to Connecticut. You know, the midnight movie that began in New York became a phenomenon. And I have friends who were in California, and it was happening in California. I think it's still going on, right?
It's still going on. But the thing about Rocky Horror that that sort of is quintessential characteristic of all these films is that they failed at the box office. Mm-hmm. They were failures. They did not get an audience, and they were out of the theaters pretty quickly. And in the days before home video, a lot of them got lost for many years, unless they showed up on television. But something like Rocky Horror was never going to play on television.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. So then, and how did the midnight movies at the drive, any sort of drive-in movies that come up in this?
There's a lot of these movies had their greatest success at drive-in, something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Right.
Which again was not a big box office hit when it came out, but continued to play as the second half of a B double feature, but did find an audience at drive-in movie theaters. And by the way, I just showed my 14-year-old daughter Texas Chainsaw Massacre. She's not even 14 yet. And she said it scared the life out of her. It is still one of the scariest movies ever made. And we also unfortunately lost Tobe Hooper during production, and we have his final interview in this, which was very, very, in fact, we lost a lot. George Romero died during the production.
Right.
We lost Stuart Gordon recently. We have his last interview. Yeah. We lost Sid Haig, who we have his last interview, who for Devil's Rejects. I don't know. I think we're the curse of horror directors and actors.
I certainly remember, again, in my childhood, all the horror movies being at the drive-in, and they called it Dusk Till Dawn. Yeah. So it would put mainly, it would be playing all night long. You'd have these horror movies.
The fun thing about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is we went to shoot Ed Neal, who played the hitchhiker. He's the only remaining cast member who's still alive. Mm-hmm. And we shot him in front of the house, the actual Texas Chainsaw house. And then Ed took us on a little tour inside the house where you see what the house looks like today compared to what it looked like in the movie. And that was a lot of fun. And that's in part two, by the way.
And then let's talk a little bit about John Waters. I mean, again, one of the masters of...
I'll tell you, want to hear something ironic? I guess this is ironic. I met John Waters at the Cannes Film Festival after the screening of To Die For.
Oh.
Your movie. And that's the first time I met him. And we were both friendly with Russ Meyer. So that was sort of the introduction. And then I didn't talk to him again until 2 years ago when we did the piece. And he's the quintessential cult director, I think. John. Yeah. An American treasure, he really is.
Oh my God. And I remember, you know, watching his movies, which I think I talk about it was considered very daring and very forbidden to go to a John Waters movie back in my day, you know,
Well, me too. In the 70s in high school, going to see Pink Flamingos was one of the biggest deals of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, at that point, being a film buff and feeling like it was forbidden and being one of the insiders who knew what Pink Flamingos was and then was able to tell everybody else about it. That was the best.
Yes. I believe I told him when we were doing that, the scene with the woman eating the egg scarred me.
Edie the Egg Lady. Edith Massey, she's a classic.
I mean, that to me is that's my definition of a cult movie. But what's your, which I think we talked about too, but you know, your definition of a cult movie for me is like someone who says, you've got to see this. It's going to blow your mind. But
exactly. It's a cult. You want to become part of the cult of Pink Flamingos. Right. Generally, I think generally, and everybody that we interview defines it. So the movie actually starts out with a series of actors and actresses describing what a cult film is to them. And it's a wide range, but generally it's a movie that failed at the box office or that, you know, didn't do what it was supposed to do. That is generally a good movie, but generally has some outrageous elements or something that makes it completely unique, that finds its audience through word of mouth and becomes sort of a cult of that movie where it's like, yeah, you got to see this. And that's how it becomes. That's how something as bad as The Room becomes The Room. You know, it's something that, you know, it's passed word of mouth and it's, you know, definitely has some elements that are going to be like, oh, that's outrageous or that's crazy or I've never seen that before.
I'm glad you brought up The Room. I was actually just about to ask about that movie. Yeah. First of all, in some ways, The Room is one of like the most interesting films I've ever seen. Like it's such a fascinating watch just because like part of the appeal is like, how did this happen? How did this get made? But to me, that's an example of a movie that there's no really redeeming artful elements to that film. So like, do you feel like some level of quality has to be a prerequisite for a cult film?
Well, I think Kevin Smith, who's in our documentary for Clerks, which is one of the cult films, he talks about The Room. And I think he kind of sums it up by saying, these were a bunch of guys, they may have had no idea what they were doing, but that they had so much passion to do what they wanted to do that hell or high water, they got that thing on the screen. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter how good or bad it was. It didn't matter how bad the acting was. It didn't matter that this nothing matched and that scenes were out of order and that it made no sense. what mattered is they got it done. They got it made. And then that theme sort of stretches a little bit to Ed Wood, who his Plan 9 from Outer Space is included pretty much in the same section, where it's the same thing. It's just the love of movie making, or just the passion to get it made, sometimes is enough. And then it may take years, like with Plan 9 for Outer Space, to appreciate it for what it is. And in the case of The Room, it was an accident. And it became the first film to really, really replicate that Rocky Horror experience in many years. And a lot of it was an accident, but that's sort of the charm of it.
Yeah. Did you see The Disaster Artist?
Yeah. And that's discussed in detail as well in our documentary.
How about Dolomite? I'd love to ask, just because that recently...
I was going to add Dolomite.
I love Dolomite and all of those Rudy Ray Moore movies. But, you know, when we started this project, we were only going to do a 2-hour documentary. And we had about 200 films that we felt were worthy, including Dolomite. And what it really came down to after a while is there's probably 10 or 12 that have to be in no matter what. And then the rest of them, you have to sort of say, who can we get? Who's going to be able to, who are we going to be able to talk to about it? So some really great cult films like Dolomite get left out because Rudy Ray Moore had passed away. There wasn't really anybody to speak to. And, you know, we were able to get Pam Grier. So Coffey and Foxy Brown made it from that era. But you just, you know, we could have done 35 hours on this and still not gotten every film that really would be considered a cult film. But Dolomite Is My Name is terrific. I heard your podcast with Larry and Scott. That was great.
It just totally captured it. And I predict that will become a cult movie, because I don't know if it really got the success it should have. I just thought Eddie Murphy was incredible.
Well, because it's on Netflix, it's going to have an audience, and it's always going to be found. It's hard to kind of figure out what is a cult film in the age of streaming. Like, if you can stream every movie, how does something become a cult film? Right. We included one film in our horror section that we felt became a cult film through streaming, and that was the god-awful Human Centipede. Mm. And by the way, the lead actor of that guy died last week too, which I can't believe.
Oh no.
Yeah, we're really bad news for the horror genre. But Human Centipede really became word of mouth through streaming, through video on demand, in the same way that we're releasing our movies, like just renting on Amazon or iTunes. And then eventually Netflix picked it up, but it never would have found an audience for not that word of mouth. But it's very hard in this era to think what could the next cult film be? And I don't know if it's going to be a Netflix film, you know?
What was interesting about Human Centipede was I almost feel like the trailer was what turned that movie into a cult film. Because I remember that was what went viral. Just like the trailer, like pitching the log line. I think just purely the shock of like, this is a movie that's coming out. To me, that's sort of what cemented the cult element of the film.
Yeah, one of our producers, Irv Slifkin, begged me to take it out. He hates it so much. But we have a great interview with Ashlyn Yenny, one of the two female stars. And Tom Six, the director, is a character, and his interview is great. He's out there, and so we definitely had to leave it in. As disgusting as Human Centipede is, and it is pretty disgusting.
Well, I think that there's always, you know, that's sort of part of the fun of the cult movies, is that there's always going to be, I can't believe you didn't include that, you know, because everybody is so passionate about the cult movies that they like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting very excellent response. People love it, but we're getting a lot of crap from people who are saying, how could you not include The Harder They Come? And I go, you're right. The Harder They Come should be in there. But if you can't get Jimmy Cliff, then you can't put The Harder They Come in there. So we're getting a lot of that. A lot of, I can't believe you didn't include this movie. And we're like, yeah, if there's volumes 5, 6, and 7, it'll definitely be included.
Well, hopefully there will be. I mean, we certainly need things to watch. You could also do, you know, you could program a film festival with watching the movies and then having the films play in rotation.
Be a great film festival.
Yeah, because again, what's always so fun about these kind of movies is you hear about films you hadn't heard of, and then it makes you want to you know, what's your appetite?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the benefits of a documentary like this. There's going to be films that people are going to go, I never saw that. I've got to see. I mean, I don't know that anybody hasn't seen Spinal Tap, but I got to see Spinal Tap, or I have to see Freaks. I never saw Freaks. You know what I'm saying? Or Reefer Madness, you know, these movies that are just not in the mainstream. Like, I got to see The Naked Kiss or Assault on Precinct 13, because they've never really been in the mainstream at all.
What about movies? Are there any cult movies that have something notorious to them? I'm thinking of the movie Detour that stars Tom Neill, and Tom Neill was this very nefarious character, and he assaulted someone. Do you think sometimes cult movies always have a little bit of a dark element to them?
Well, no, I don't know if it's necessarily dark in the production side. I think there are some outrageous elements that make them, like, I think you used the word notorious. I mean, obviously the end of Pink Flamingos is notorious for Divine. You know, the Sam Fuller film, Naked Kiss. Michael Dante, the star, I mean, he's basically playing a child molester. And he talks about Sam Fuller talked him into this and admitted to him, this could hurt your career, but 50 years from now, people are going to be talking about The Naked Kiss. And it's, I don't know, you couldn't make that film today. Nobody would touch that film today because it is a little, it's very notorious. It's also a terrific film, but it's a little on the edge. And I don't think you see that film made in today.
I love The Naked Kiss. There's a certain woodenness to the acting, though, and to all of Sam Fuller's movies, but that you kind of get into. It's sort of, it reminds me, I mean, I know it's, you know, hard to relate this, but it's like Ann Biller's movie, The Love Witch. There's a certain quality to the woodenness that is part of the film, and all of Sam Fuller's movies, to me, have that same quality.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I will say, though, that The Naked Kiss has maybe the greatest opening sequence in movie history. Yeah.
I know.
It's unbelievable. And then you guys talk about that in the documentary as well.
Yeah, that is great. I remember the first time I saw it. And that was a movie, too, that people had said, you got to see this. You got to see this. And then I saw that. And Shock Corridor.
Shock Corridor, yeah. And White Dog, by the way.
Oh, and White Dog.
Yeah.
Which is a movie. Now, for years, when I was in New York in the 90s, I think they showed it at, you know, Lincoln Center or something like that. And that was the whole thing was that it hadn't been in circulation. They hadn't been allowed to see the film.
It never got a proper release.
Yeah.
It never did get a proper release. I think now you can get a Criterion version. So it has its proper release, I guess, for history.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. I mean, who would have thought, did we ask John Waters that? Who would have thought that his cult movies are getting Criterion Collection?
Yes.
Movies, you know?
Polyester with the scratch and sniff card.
Yeah, that was wild. What year was that? Because I remember going to the theater. I wish I still had my card.
I do have it. In fact, I could show you. I don't want to move out of the screen here. It's here in my office somewhere. But I think it was, you know, what year was Polyester? Well, it was after Desperate Living. So
81.
81. There you 81. Go. I was going to say sometime in the 80s.
Yeah. I definitely remember going to the theater. It may have even been like I'd just gotten to New York or something like that. I don't know. But I remember, you know, the cool kids. You went with the cool kids to see that one.
That was great. The scratch and sniff card is 40 years old and it still works. A little bit. Still works a little bit.
It's probably very invaluable.
It's old and messed up. But if you have a DVD of the movie, you need the scratch and sniff card. So.
That's right. Now, what about William Castle movies? Does he come in to play?
Not make it. Again, we had some of those on the wall, but you know, you have to cut from 250 down to 50. And so,
What about any of Joe Dante's movies? Any of his films make it?
No, I think Joe's movies are a little more mainstream and they were big hits. I mean, Gremlins was a big hit. Interspace was a big hit. So I don't think you could.
Burbs.
Huh?
The Burbs.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that they were if they're mainstream studio movies that got a big release and did well, they're not going to get to the cult status, you know?
Yeah. It'll be interesting. Again, once we come out of this, there's so many movies that are things that are happening. This is this whole void of people not really seeing things, and will they catch on?
Well, I think this is a movie. This is a documentary series for movie lovers made by movie lovers. I mean, that's why we asked you to be one of the hosts. We love movies. We love cult movies. It's what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to do stuff like this growing up. Mm-hmm. And so when you have the opportunity, you're going to make it big, and you're going to make it bold, and you're going to make it fun. And you just appeal. We're just appealing to people who love movies. And I think people will watch this and then want to see Harold and Maude. They will want to see Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, because they're going to see, oh my God, that sounds so interesting.
Yes. So, and then my next question is just for some of the women that are like cult icons, some of the actresses and films, are they involved?
Yeah, I think Pam Grier's number one. You can, I mean, Pam Grier had a great career, still has a good career, but when you talk to film buffs, they think Pam Grier never got her due. She should be one of the biggest stars in history. And when you go back and you look at those movies, they were bold, and she was empowering, and she took control of a situation, and she did. Can I use language or not?
It's fine. Yeah.
She didn't take shit from anybody. And I think as great as Pam Grier is, I think a lot of film people think she's underrated. And so and her interview is great because she is a conversationalist. Another one that you could talk to for 3 hours and like Jeff Goldblum and ask two questions, and she'll just go and go and go. So we interviewed her a couple of times.
Oh yeah. There are any other women? I know a lot of women from horror are quite famous. They do the rounds, you know, doing these, you know, collectible shows and things like that.
In terms of horror movies?
Yeah, what I'm trying to think of.
Our horror movies included, like I said, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and unfortunately Marilyn Burns passed away. We did the two George Romero movies, Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. We did The Devil's Rejects. We did Human Centipede. So Ashlyn Yenny, the star of Human Centipede, is great in this. We did Devil's Rejects. We did Reanimator. Now, Mary Warrenoff. We could talk about Mary Warrenoff a little bit. Mary Warrenoff, who is in three of our cult films, is one of the most fascinating and interesting and underrated actors of any generation. And so she was in Death Race 2000, and she's hilarious. She's in Rock and Roll High School, and she's in Eating Raoul. And and she is fantastic. And so Mary gets a lot of play in this. And they call her one of the great cult actresses, but she's just really a great underrated actress. She really is.
What other films has she been in that we would know aside from those films? I'm trying to think of, did she only do cult movies, or did any of these actors sort of cross over and do?
Well, I think, you know, a cult movie by definition, nobody sets out to make a cult movie. If you set out to make a cult movie, you're going to fail. Cult movies, you don't say, oh, I'm going to make a cult movie. No, cult movies make you. They find their audience. So I don't think Mary Warrenoff, when she made Eating Raoul, I mean, she talks about her and Paul Bartel. They would get a little money, they would shoot, then they would run out of money, then he'd have to raise more money, and then he would buy film, and then they would shoot, and he would call her up and say, all right, I got some more money, let's shoot some more. That's like not cult filmmaking, that's just handmade, you know, filmmaking. And they hope that it's going to be a big hit, and it bombs, but then it finds that audience.
Right.
So, I mean, and I think in the case of the Roger Corman movies, Rock and Roll High School and Death Race 2000, nobody thinks they're going to be big hits. You know, the Roger Corman movies, and yet they go on to be a couple of the best cult movies of all time.
Yeah.
And Rock and Roll High School in particular. I mean, she is hilarious, and the movie is great. And we have Alan Arkush. We have an interview with Alan Arkush. He's one of the best people you could ever talk to. He was just fantastic.
God. Again, encyclopedic.
Another film buff, you know? and just another film buff. So, but I don't think you can't set out to make a cult film. So if a filmmaker does that, forget it. You know, look at the trauma films, you know, Toxic Avenger, and they try to make cult films, and that's why they don't have cult status, because they were self-conscious. They were trying to do this, you know, it doesn't work.
I may have mentioned this in the documentary. I never got to see it, but my, in gimmicks with cult films, my older brothers went to see Mark of the Devil.
Yeah.
And they got the vomit bag with the,
right.
You know, I mean, come on. This is great.
Yeah. Well, that's the big famous scene where they just cut the guy's tongue out and it looks so real. That I saw at a drive-in movie theater growing up in Philadelphia.
Can Mark you believe our parents just sent us off to see it? Now, I wasn't allowed to see it, but I was like, I want to see Mark of the Devil.
I had parents, but they weren't present. I mean, they allowed me to take a train from Philadelphia to New York City to go see pro wrestling by myself at age 14. So it was very different back then in the 70s.
I know. I mean, all these, with all the horror, all the horror movies. But I just remember, oh my God, what was the other? Then there was a movie that came out. What was it? The Basket Case series.
Oh yeah, Basket Case.
Yeah. What about those?
Well, Basket Case, interesting thing about Basket Case, that was really a home video cult movie. That came out at the very beginning when people were putting out VHS. So it didn't really get a cult following in theaters per se, but in the days when people were getting their VCRs for the first time in the early 80s, there weren't that many movies available. Right. So you rent everything because you were so excited to have the VCR. Mm-hmm. And I remember Basket Case came out from a little company called Media. And at the time I was in college and I was working at Movies Unlimited, which was the biggest video store. And, you know, went on to be the biggest mail order video company in the country, but it was the first big superstar. And I was working there and, you know, we could not keep Basket Case in stock. And we were talking about 40 or 50 copies at a time on rent every night. And then that, I would say that was a cult film brought on by home video. Later examples of that would be something like Office Space, which is in our documentary, where that movie completely failed at the box office. But then look how popular Basket Case is today, strictly through home video.
Office Space, yes. Let's talk about cult comedies.
Sure.
Final Tap, of course.
Right. I talked about Rock and Roll High School. We start out, our comedy section starts out with three high school movies. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which was, believe it or not, a failure when it first came out.
Wow.
Rock and Roll High School, and then Valley Girl, which is a particular favorite of our director, Danny Wolf. And it was cool to kind of meet Martha Coolidge and talk about how she made that movie and what she went through to make that movie. Actually, and Amy Heckerling, who did Fast Times at Ridgemont High, it's interesting to talk to female directors from that era fighting their way uphill in a male-dominated industry to try to make the movies that they wanted to make and the fights that they had with the studios to make them.
Yes.
Great stories. And so they deserve their cult status. And then we kind of move into Napoleon Dynamite. And we have the entire cast of Napoleon Dynamite.
Wow.
Everybody wanted to do it because everybody that was in that movie loves that movie. So that was a lot of fun.
You're right. I forgot about that. And that one came out of nowhere.
Exactly. It changed fashion. It changed perceptions of what a nerd was. It made being a nerd cool, finally. And so that was important.
Yeah, that's interesting. Comedy one. Any other comedy?
Well, Office Space is Mike Judge. It was great. And we have a bunch of the people from Office Space who are in it talking about it.
I have a couple of comedy questions. I hate to interrupt, but I just rewatched MacGruber last night. Some of those SNL films, I don't know if you caught like Hot Rod or like even Popstar recently, I thought was a pretty underappreciated film. Any like 21st century comedies that you think of?
Super Troopers?
Yeah.
Kingpin? You know, Super Troopers was an utter failure that became a big hit, you know, and we got Jim Gaffigan. Now he's only in it for a short time, but boy, it was great to have Jim Gaffigan talking about that because it did a lot for his career. You know, he's one of the top stand-up comics in the country now. Mm-hmm. Kingpin, which was great because Peter Farrelly said, nobody wants to talk about Kingpin. Everybody wants to talk about something about Mary. And so he was so pleased that, we loved Kingpin and thought Kingpin was really a unique cult film. And I guess Best in Show is fairly recent, which is, you know, which is amazing. This is another one I showed my daughter recently that she loved. So
such a funny movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny because you think of the comedies as almost becoming that they're successful. You don't think that they, but you know,
every one of the ones I mentioned was a failure when it first came out, you know? So that's why There's Something About Mary is not a cult film, because it was a big hit. But Kingpin, the one that they did right after,
right,
they said, well, I guess everything we're going to do is going to be a big hit. And it was a total dud. And it's actually a really great, very, very funny movie.
Yeah, that one really has some famous people in it. And I always think of that, too, as someone incredibly famous, you know, that they got in the cast and they're doing something completely different than they ever did before. Not that it would make your list, but like The Cable Guy with Jim Carrey, you know, something like that.
That's a bit of an underrated film, don't you think?
Totally.
And nobody liked that film because they wanted to see Jim Carrey do the same thing. It was really subversive. It really was.
The off-brand, you know, movies. Well, comedians playing villains is his own brand, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, not really villains, but, you know, Jerry Lewis and King of Comedy.
King of Comedy was great.
Is a cult movie.
Well, we had that on the list. We thought it might be a little, you know, a little too popular, but it could have made it, and it may make volume 4, 5, and 6. You know?
Well, here's an interesting question. So for instance, when I was in school and King of Comedy came out, it was just a failure. And that's one of those things that we talk about. Now it's considered a success. It took years and years and years for it finally, now people say it's a masterpiece, but it was for many years, it was not considered.
I think it made people uncomfortable.
Yes.
I think it really made people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that sort of has its own, you know, it either works or it doesn't work, you know?
Right.
You know, I think people were really uncomfortable with the De Niro role, and Jerry Lewis was not funny. He was playing it straight. And I think it sometimes when you have expectations and it doesn't reach your expectations, you don't get it right away. It takes multiple viewings, you know?
Are there any movies that are like wonderful catastrophes, like Valley of the Dolls, which was a movie that I participated in a live reenactment in the 90s of Valley of the Dolls. I don't know if you remember.
Well, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is in our documentary, the Russ Meyer film. Yeah. And we do have most of the living cast from that as well. I think Showgirls is a good example. Showgirls is a bona fide cult hit right now. And we have Gina Gershon, who was great, talking about the very fact that it was such a disaster and was so laughed at. And yet everybody that talks to Gina Gershon all these years later, all they want to talk about is Showgirls. And she says, where were you 20 years ago? All you want to do is talk about it. And it was a disaster of a film. Everything about it was a disaster. And yet today it's a quotable, there's Showgirls festivals. People go to midnight screenings dressed up. It's people recite the dialogue. It's a bona fide cult film. And I think more so in the gay community than it is the straight community. Although it's pretty funny there too.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's a great Showgirls. So now I know that Jeff is dying to ask you if we can segue briefly, because we're running out of time, that and if you're comfortable, I know nothing about the adult film industry. But he said you were peripherally involved with the adult film industry.
Yeah, my claim to fame, I got detoured on my way from Philadelphia to Hollywood. I had a 30-year detour. I founded AVN, the Adult Video News, the magazine, and the AVN Awards, the famous porn awards in Vegas. That's my fault. I created that.
I'm from Connecticut. I don't know.
Everybody's from Connecticut.
What, without being too graphic, what sort of awards do people
get? Well, we had Best Picture and Best Actor and Best Actress.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Best.
And we had Best Cinematography and Best Screenplay and Best Sex Scene and Best Orgy and Best Lesbian Sex Scene. And, you know, it became a real industry unto itself. I'm working on a scripted comedy television show. I have the pilot. And I have a great pitch, and I'm trying to pitch it out and try to tell that story on television as a half hour comedy. It's a pretty outrageous story because I'm a total nerd and I had no game and no idea what I was doing. But the reason I started AVN, Adult Video News, because I was a film buff and because I had a journalism degree and I was working at Movies Unlimited and I didn't want to work in retail and I wanted to be a writer or a publisher because I published magazines, but I wanted to come to Hollywood. And we wrote the first issues of Adult Video News. The reviews of the movies are written just like any other movie review. We were so serious about it that our seriousness, we became the standard that people look to, like Variety is to the movie industry or Billboard was to the music industry. My magazine was to the porn industry.
Yeah.
And I got out of it 10 years ago to pursue a more mainstream career. And of course, ended up doing a bunch of adult documentaries for Showtime. So,
and a scripted series, right?
Huh?
And a scripted series as well.
Yeah, it was called Submission. It was a low budget, sort of a female director who I'm friendly with. It was sort of her answer to what 50 Shades of Grey should be, because she felt 50 Shades was incorrect. And I don't know. I think I'm out of license with Showtime, but it's available. It's available various places. So 6-episode series. It's probably on their app, the Showtime app.
Post COVID, is there going to be an adult film industry?
I think I left the industry right around the time where I felt it was ending, meaning once it was available online for free.
Right.
All of my customers who were video producers and movie makers who used to advertise with me, they started to lose their businesses pretty quickly. And once my ad dollars started to go down the tube, then we were dependent on sex toy ads. And I just, you know, it was time. It was time to get out. I don't like the idea of porn being free on the internet. I think there should be a barrier of entry. I don't like the thought of kids being able to get it. I really don't.
Everything you say sounds pornographic now when you say pornographic.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I'm kidding.
I don't hide from my past. I try to embrace it.
Oh, there's no, you know, and I, like I said, I know nothing. I just didn't. It's just not my cup of tea. But I remember working with actors and they'd go on a plane and they'd go to Vegas for the awards.
That was us. Yeah, that was us.
Yeah, so it must have been a big.
Oh, it was a big deal. I mean, we had anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 people. We had a television contract with Showtime. I mean, it's still on Showtime. I think we started that probably in the early 2000s. So it was a big deal. We had major stars and every rapper or, you know, hip hop artist wanted to play the show. And I can't tell you the number of celebrities who came to watch the show, who stood in the back or came backstage. And, you know, it was a big deal.
That's what I'm telling you.
Yeah, it was the truth.
I'd be doing a movie with some very sophisticated actor. Oh, I'm going to blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah.
We talked with John Cameron Mitchell. You know, he has pretty graphic sex scenes in his films, and he says, you know, sex can be used on screen as like a toolbox for an artist, you know, in the same way that painters have a variety of colors. You can use sex as a storytelling device.
Yeah, exactly. John's in our movie, you know, Hedwig and the Angry Inch made our list. So he's in there, and he was a fantastic, really intelligent guy. A lot of interesting stuff to say. But Short Bus was pretty hardcore. I mean, it was hard. What do you say? Pretty hardcore. It's a hardcore pornographic movie.
Yeah,
it really is.
I remember when it played up at Sundance and people walked out and it was a big.
Yeah, it's like Lars von Trier. I saw one of his films in competition at Cannes had hardcore penetration. I can't believe I'm seeing this. If this played in the States, he'd be going to jail on obscenity charges. Here, it's you know, he's Palme d'Or potential, you know.
Yeah, it's so strange. You know, again, movies, movies reflect the society. And so, you know, it's sometimes it's strange. Like I'll look at movies of the 90s, and there's, you know, there's a lot of violent scenes, sex scenes, raping of women, and, you know, that you look at it now, you go, this would never fly today. Yeah. So I think everything goes through kind of transitions. And we were talking at the top of the show, when I was growing up, you know, pornography movies, there was like the X-rated, and they play at the drive-in, you know, Andy Warhol movies and things like that.
Right. You know, the film that I was mentioning, the Lars von Trier film, was called The Idiots. Now, I know later when he did Nymphomaniac, there was some explicit sex as well. But the one in Cannes Film Festival was The Idiots. Although maybe Nymphomaniac played in Cannes also. He's a darling of the Cannes Film Festival. So,
yeah. Oh, well, that's fascinating. Well, Jeff, do you have any, tell everybody again where it's going to, it's where we can see it. So just
okay. So April 21st, it's called Time Warp Midnight Madness. It's the greatest cult films of all time, wherever you rent movies. So if you rent them from your cable system, it's probably there. Easiest is probably iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, Fandango Now. Anywhere that you rent a movie, if you just want to rent a movie, and it's available to buy, I think it's only $10 to buy, or to rent, I think it's $4.99 in HD. And then volume 2 is just a month later, and volume 3 a month after that. And you can watch them out of order if you want.
Okay, fantastic. I'm so excited. Well, I hope it continues. I hope.
Yeah, well, and it was great having you. You're great on the panel, and you're funny, and you stand up well to those three guys. And even though Dante and John Waters love to kind of dominate the conversation, you were good. You stood up to them pretty well.
That's always, you know, it's funny with people with, movie people are they really are very opinionated.
Yes, of course. That's why everyone was there.
So you never know.
We love movies. We're film buffs.
I know. It would be very argumentative. My last question is, what is your personal favorite cult movie?
That changes all the time.
Yeah.
I'll stick to what's in the documentary series. Well, I think I was friends with Russ Meyer, and so I've always had a soft spot for Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yeah.
It blew my mind when I saw it the first time, and it always blows my mind. And then having Dolly Reed in our documentary and Erica Gavin in our documentary and John Lazar, it was like chills meeting these people. And then I would think, you know, we got to interview John Cleese for Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Was always sort of,
I always felt like
that's one of the quintessential cult films, because that's another movie that was a mess when they were making it and that nobody really got them, you know? And I felt like being a Monty Python fan gave me an edge because I was an insider, because I knew something that everybody else didn't know. So having that, and it still holds up. So that was also one of my favorites, but it changes, you know. Female Trouble from John Waters is like one of my favorite cult films, and probably 25 others are favorite cult films.
I love Female Trouble. That's I think that's a Criterion release. I don't know if it made the for me Office Space.
It's on our list. Yeah, it made it. It made our
Office
list.
Space is probably one of my favorites. Spinal Tap, of course. Probably didn't make your list, but Albert Brooks's movie Real Life.
Oh, well, wait, I'm the biggest Albert Brooks fan in the world. Real Life.
That's a movie that I always, you know, when Charles Grodin accidentally kills the horse in Real Life, it's just one of my favorite and prescient, you know, completely prescient film about the future.
Yeah. Lost in America, Defending Your Life. I love Albert Brooks. So,
yeah. God, I can't believe we're getting to the end of our conversation. I didn't, and you knew Russ Meyer. I should have, I'm sure somebody's screaming at me going, give me a very brief rundown of Russ Meyer, just so people would get mad at me.
Well, it's hard to give you a 1 minute Russ Meyer story, but my connection to Russ Meyer was when I started this adult video news, AVN, I wanted to do an interview with him because I was such a big fan. Now, he didn't make porn movies. He made adult films, nudie films. He was like one of the creators of the Nudie Cuties. And he sort of was First Amendment, breaking the rules of censorship. He was a pioneer, definitely not a pornographer. But I called his office and he answered the phone. and agreed to do an interview with me, a Q&A. And I was like, how does this guy answer his own phone? It's Russ Meyer, you know? It's like, you don't call Quentin Tarantino and he answers his phone. And that, to me, he's Quentin Tarantino. And we did the interview and it was in the magazine and we became friends. And before I started my own convention, you know, the AVN show in Las Vegas, all the adult people would go to the CES show in Las Vegas. And Russ invited me to share his booth space to put my magazines out. And we just became great friends. So before I moved to LA in 91, from like 85 to 1990, I would come to LA 3 or 4 times a year to see clients and customers and sell advertising. And I'd stay at Russ's house. And he had this unbelievable monument to himself in the Hollywood Hills. His house was painted bright orange, which was the color of his video boxes. And And the inside of his house was a monument, a museum of Russ Meyer. And he was crazy and he was funny and he was fantastic with great stories and, you know, telling me, you know, the history of all the women and all the film shoots and everything. And he let me sleep at his house and I slept on an old army cot in a attic with film cases around me, with big film reels around me. And it was just something else. And just, we became friends and he introduced me to Roger Ebert and I got to stay at Roger Ebert's summer home in New Buffalo, Michigan. And he was outrageous, but Russ was one of these people, as if he was your friend, he was your friend and it didn't matter. Yeah. Unfortunately, he in later in life, came down with Alzheimer's. So the last part of his life, he was sort of not in great shape and we lost touch and he forgot who I was and, you know, but it was a great 15 years.
God. Well, that's for people. At least he got to see success towards the end of his life. You know, people really discovered him.
You know, two of his films, Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls made our documentary. If he knew that we were calling his film cult films, he would be very angry. My films are not cult films, Fishbein. They are masterpieces. They are not cult films. And that's how he would talk. And he would call me Fishbein. He wouldn't call me by my first name.
So. Yeah, I mean, Valley of Dolls also, I believe, has a Criterion release, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. It's
a really good one.
It is a masterpiece. If anybody hasn't seen that, if I could recommend one film, that's the one to see.
Okay, that's a really, you're right, that's a good one. And although, man, it's so fun to see it in with a crowd.
Oh, yeah.
The first, I saw it, you know, I saw it at my house, and I said, all right, I get it, it's fun. But then I saw it in a crowd.
Yeah. It played at the Arrow in Santa Monica about a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
And Dolly Reed introduced it, and it was fun to see it with a crowd again.
Yeah, it's definitely fun. All right.
I first saw it in college in a film course. Actually, a teacher taught it in my film course, so that's where I first saw it.
Well, he definitely has a lot of, you know, it's not schlocky. It's cool camera angles, and he obviously Tarantino influences, and you know.
Yeah, everyone. You talk to any filmmaker, they love Russ.
Yeah, the colors of it are nice. California, locale, you know, all of that.
And Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill looks like a John Ford Western. So, and it's beautiful and it's black and white and it's amazing. So that I recommend those two Russ films for sure.
Yes. And that Beyond the Valley of the Dolls was interesting again in my lifetime went from, because when Siskel and Ebert would do the show and Siskel would always jibe Roger Ebert about it. And then by, you know, in his lifetime, it became a huge sort of art house masterpiece. So good on him. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There was supposed to be a Hollywood film based on that, based on Roger and Russ making that movie. And for some reason, Will Ferrell was supposed to play Russ Meyer, which was weird casting, but it fell off. It never happened. And then Adam Rifkin is supposed to be doing or was trying to do a TV series based on Russ's life, which hopefully will happen because Adam's kind of an interesting filmmaker as well and loves Faster Pussycat and loves Russ Meyer as well. And also has some great Russ stories. So he was going to turn those stories into his TV series. So.
Adam's a doll. Is he in the movie?
Yeah. Yeah. He's great. Is he the best on camera? I mean, I invited him to talk about Russ Meyer because he was working on this TV series. But then he talked about Harold and Maude, and he just talked about a bunch of films. And he's also another person who could have been on that panel, film buff. But he's got a great personality. He's terrific on camera.
So. I love Adam. He's great. These are all my buddies who I miss. We're all in quarantine. Anyway,
yeah, well, we're all in quarantine.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Well,
thank you for having me. And
watches it.
Being part of the project, which we appreciated it. I know it's been a couple of years, but it was worth waiting for.
Totally. It was, like I said, we get to hang out. I was having lunch with Joe Dante and we got us lunch. It was, we had fun over lunch. I remember the what's fun about days like that is that the discussion doesn't end when the camera's off. You know, we went into lunch and we were.
Yeah. Remember what Kevin Pollak said? He said, let's do this every year. Let's just do this once a year. Let's plan next year's now.
Love that. Yeah. Kevin and I have made a number of films together. I think he's number one in the amount of movies we've co-starred. We've been in like 4 or 5 movies together.
Yeah.
So I miss seeing Kevin.
Well, when you watch the movie, you'll see him sitting right next to you.
Cutting me off. Listening to John. If Joe Dante and John Waters dominate, they deserve to dominate.
Yeah, they were
amazing. You know, what am I going to add to what the master?
You added plenty. Trust me. It's very valuable. Trust me.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for being on the show.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
And we'll talk soon.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Paul.
You got it.
In terms of, other stuff, make sure you guys watch Paul's new movie. It's going to be amazing. And Ileana, I'll let you take us out. But we always say life is
like a movie. And I finally getting my info right with the sweatshirt. So I just want to make sure that this is my, and it's absolutely awesome. I've been wearing it the whole time. This hoodie is from Global Angel. And it's an activewear brand, and it automatically, if you get it, Global Angel, they will donate 25% of the purchase back to the partner charity that you select from their menu. And it's a great way to shop while giving back. So Global Angel, check them out. And thank you guys for the sweatshirt. So that's and then now back to my PCM. Are we doing an adult movie? What's happening here? What is happening here? Now I'm back to the glamour. We're going to end with a TCM Film Festival. And Jeff, I miss you. This is so...
I know, but we'll be back next week. I'm out to a couple people, Ileana, so we can talk after the show. But until then, life is
like a movie. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. And keep watching movies, and we will see you next week. So long.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.